there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. Okay, so for today's episode, this is a conversation with a new client residing in Singapore, although you should be able to pick up where he's originally from pretty quickly from his accent. We had a nice long conversation about all practical matters related to property investment here in Japan, but also investment in general, both here in Japan and also from a more global perspective. So we explain how things work here in comparison with other countries, what is similar, what is unique to Japan. We break down the popular investment asset classes of choice, what can be had for his budget, which is approximately 20 million Japanese yen or 200,000 euros, and how we can work with that budget to also achieve diversification if possible. So we cover attractive locations within Japan, and we also break down the purchase process and explain where we fit into it. And then we talk some procedural, so how foreign exchange and money transfers work, how to establish and maintain relationships with realtors in Japan, and why it is that we pursue potential properties one at a time. We do some due diligence, some deal analysis. We talk about tenancy laws, tenant profiles, the advantages of purchasing tenanted versus vacant, renovations, repairs, both between tenants and otherwise, purchase management costs, taxes, insurance, insurance coverage, insurance compensation, you name it. So a really good in-depth conversation about all things related to property investment in the land of the rising sun. Enjoy the episode, and I'll see you again on the other side. Okay, so I've scrolled down through your email. You were talking about investment properties at a budget of approximately 20 million yen. Was that about right?
Yeah, correct. I mean, basically, it's the sum is a bit like, you know, we can discuss what makes sense and so on, because it's the first investment in Japan for us, right? So, I mean, we have some property in Singapore. I have also something in Germany. And, you know, basically, especially Singapore is for investment not really a good, at the moment at least, it's not really practical, right?
Because yeah.
We have price hikes at the moment, and I mean, renting our condo units at the moment, the yield is okay, but we know exactly what will happen if the market is cooling off a bit again, because then the rents are going down and then also the yield is basically gone.
That's the first time actually I've heard a Singapore person say that the yields are okay. I've never heard that before.
At the moment, I mean, if you have an existing property that you bought, let's say 3-4 years ago, and then with these price hikes that we see at the moment, it's not too bad. I mean, like on the most of the condo units, you were able to increase rent by, you know, quite a bit. I would say like 20%.
Okay.
And this 20% price hike is giving you some good return in that period. But we all know what happens, right? I mean, it will not stay on that level for the whole time, because the market is like Hong Kong. It's like coming in waves. And when the wave is going down again, if you bought a property at the wrong time, it's hurting you quite a bit on your investment. If you want to get cash out, right? If you're really speculating on appreciation, it's okay. I mean, you can do that, and you can hope, of course, that somebody's building an underground station near your house and value by accident just drops up. But normally, our experience is like, it's either you buy it when it's really cheap and you're lucky, or I mean, you're speculating by buying something somewhere which is a bit more like, it's hard to say in Singapore outskirts, it's like one city state, right?
Yeah. But
if you buy it somewhere where you're not close to any station, and then, you know, you just hope that, okay, in the development plan, it looks like they will put a line there in the next 10 years.
Okay.
You know, in 10 years, the property will definitely gain because, you know, people will look into this area because it's connected to a station. But that's basically
speculation.
Basically the background.
Yeah. Yeah. It's no, well, I mean, I guess we're probably the exact opposite here in the sense that Japan is definitely a cash flow market and not a speculative place. But the thing is, if you're going to be buying a single asset for 20 million yen, you're probably going to end up with an asset that's going to be very similar to what you used to from Singapore cash flow wise. So 20 million yen is not enough to buy a small building, or at least not in any attractive city. And houses are not really the best investment asset in Japan. They're not made of durable materials, and I mean, you get the entire structure maintenance on you as opposed to a condo unit without any of the benefits that you'd get with a larger building. So you're probably looking at a single condo unit if you're going to buy a single asset.
Which actually, the idea is a bit like, you know, I have two things in my head, and maybe you can give your comment on it because you have, of course, more experience on this than I have. But looking into the market, and also I've been to Japan many times for business. So I'm traveling there normally like 4 or 5 times a year. I just came from Japan, actually. I have been in Japan 2 weeks ago for 3 weeks in different cities. And I mean, when looking at the people there, demographic-wise, and you know, when you talk to business partners we have, I mean, what would make sense is, of course, to look for like smaller units, like a typical, I don't know, studio, or how they call it, like 1LDK, 1DK, 1K, something small. And then, I mean, for me, it would be fine if we say, okay, if we find, let's say, 2 units that is, let's say, you know, in a certain value, and where we see, okay, cash flow is good, I think that would be a good point maybe to kickstart something, because my plan is to diversify more. And from my mindset, it's like we started in Singapore and we came to the point where it makes sense still, but then kicks in the stamp duty here, because the stamp duty is, you know, it gets more, the more properties you own, the more stamp duty you have to pay. So it doesn't make more sense anymore to invest more in Singapore, because we have something, and you know, everything additionally I would buy now is killing me on the stamp duty. Then Germany at the moment is not a good place to invest, and you know, it's too expensive simply too expensive.
Even up north, like I heard Leipzig was not a bad location.
Okay. I mean, the problem I would have is like, my mindset is always like, I'm from the north part, right? So you're thinking then automatically like, okay, if I ever would go back, can I maybe utilize this property? Because in Germany, you will not get anything cheap, right? I mean, like if we're talking about 200,000 euro, I mean, at the moment, what you're getting is what you could get is very limited.
Yeah.
And, you know, it would not be in a nice neighborhood normally. And you also would know that the clientele of people who would rent this is like, you know, let's say it's more difficult to maintain it as a passive investment. If you're living there, it's different because you could go there, you are in control of it, you could check up once in a while and so on. But living in Singapore and not being in Germany, it's too troublesome.
Yeah. So in Japan, again, if we're going for a single asset, it would be a super central location in any other city, or a reasonable location in Tokyo or central Osaka, say. But Tokyo and Osaka will probably, a single asset at this budget will probably get you 3%, maybe 4% before tax if you're lucky. In other cities, maybe 4.5-5%. But if we try to break that down into 2 assets, that will probably get us something a little bit older, a little bit smaller, with higher yield. Without compromising too much on location. So still in a big city, maybe not right smack in the middle of the city, but a good location. Then two assets of 10 million each probably would make more sense from a yield perspective, I would say.
Okay. That's what I was thinking also, because I mean, from what I hear, at least from my colleagues there, because, you know, I was talking with my colleagues, that's also why it was kickstarting. And then, of course, you're running into all of these problems, like, you know, as a foreigner, you're not able to make a bank account. As a foreigner, it will be very hard to find an agent dealing with you, you know, all these things. And then, of course, you know, this idea came up, I think, like 2 years back. And, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, when the market was actually quite good in Japan, as far as I heard from my colleagues. And basically, at that time, it was like it's nearly impossible without, you know, any services to do that. And, you know, basically, that's why I was, you know, investigating over the last year, more or less, and then also end up finally on your webpage, actually. And
You just quoted 50% of the reasons for our existence is the fact that you can't open a bank account, you can't do anything in English, and nobody wants to work with you. And the other half is probably, I mean, Japan's an honest place. You're not going to get swindled here, but agents are still agents. They're transactional. They're not going to tell you what questions to ask and not going to guide you through due diligence. They're just going to try to seal the deal. So the other reason that we exist is that people would like to pay us for our expertise to be on their side and make sure that they're just getting the best. Again, you're not going to get swindled, but you want to make sure you're getting the best deal for your money.
Okay.
So yeah, you've read the explanation of services document. You understand roughly how we work, right? Did you have any questions about that?
Actually, from the point, I mean, like what I understand, and you can maybe correct me on this one, is basically that we will, for the start, that we will work like, you know, I mean, of course, first of all, having this talk and also, you know, looking into what option, maybe also for our side to maybe look a bit at what is the budget that we really want to spend. And then from the other point is that we would start engaging you, right? I mean, that would be the starting point if we really go further that road. And also making some upfront payments, correct?
We can put in a few hours of complimentary research, and we're always happy to exchange emails and have a chat. But once you want us to actually dig deeper into specific properties, start contacting listing agents and sellers, and maybe conduct a few more hours of research to look at other cities, from that point we do need to be engaged. So we need our fee estimate paid in advance. That's going to be based on what you think the budget is. And then post-settlement will debit or credit, depending on whatever the end purchase price is. And sometime before we actually can sign the contract on your behalf, you'll also need to have two documents signed and witnessed to enable us to represent you here.
Okay. These witnesses of these documents, does it have to be the Japanese embassy?
Notary public. Any notary public.
Okay.
Well, any notary public who can understand a document in English. Yeah.
Luckily, we're in Singapore.
Singapore, yeah. Germany, maybe not that easy, but Singapore, okay.
Correct. Yeah, okay, that's good to know, because, I mean, for us, I mean, luckily, we have a good Japanese embassy here, because, you know, during the pandemic time for the visa and so on, they were actually quite, you know, responsive, and they're quite good. So if there's anything needed from the embassy, it would have not been a big issue, I think. But
if you're not Japanese residents, there's no, we don't need to involve Japanese consulates or notary publics or anything.
Okay, that's good to know. So basically, that's a notary public is totally fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then that's it. So naturally, throughout the research process, we're going to be looking at a bunch of properties. Don't expect the first one that you look at to be the one you're going to end up purchasing. But the purchase fee that you pay us represents you, it's a fixed price that represents you until you end up settling on a property.
Okay. And then from the procedure otherwise, it's like, I mean, when we work together, I guess that you will look into the market. I mean, you will look what is coming there with your agents that you are normally working with, what is free on the market, what you can find over other portals, let's say like that. And if we're coming really, let's say now, I mean, from the first point, let's say we find a property where you say, okay, this makes sense. It's a location wise, it's okay. It's within a station. It is somewhere at a larger city. And let's say it has a certain amount of value that it's written off for, or it's published for. Let's say just an example now, let's say 60 million or 6 million yen as an example now.
Yeah.
And let's say we say, okay, we want to make an official offer for this one, because my understanding in Japan normally is like, from my business background, right? It's like, if you start approaching somebody seriously about something, like asking for an inquiry or so, I mean, normally at that point it gets quite serious. I mean, like, it's differently than in Europe, right? Where you can just say, yeah, oh, please give me a, I want to offer this or make a letter of.
Yeah, I'm glad that you recognize that, because that's one of the main points we have to educate new customers about. In the West, we're very used to, you know, shooting in all directions, submitting offers on 5-6 properties, and then just going ahead with the one we like the most. But if we do that in Japan, that agent is not going to work with us again. It's just not done here. So what we would need to do is get our research results, prioritize them to see which one, on paper at least, which one looks the most attractive, and start tackling them one by one. So we go with the first one, we make inquiries. Once we submit an offer, it's expected, it's not legally binding, but it's expected that if nothing turns up during due diligence, we're going to move forward with the deal. We're not going to just pull back because we changed our mind. Mm-hmm. But the due diligence information is only going to be available post offer. The agents, it's a very fast market here, so the agents and the sellers don't go out of the way to start collecting documents for tire kickers. And once they have an offer, they'll start providing, if the unit is tenanted, they'll provide tenant information, the building renovation history, the total reserve funds. And then we look at all of that information and we decide if we're moving forward or pulling back or maybe amending the offer price, for example, if there's a higher risk factor. Uh-huh. Right. So we can pull the offer back because of that due diligence info, but not because just we had a change of heart. And then once we sign the contract, pay the 10% deposit, that's when it becomes legally binding.
Okay. So from that point onwards, it's basically like a legal binding contract. And then it will run down the road of course, getting all the legal things in place and then to doing the transfer.
Whatever you're used to from any other country, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Definitely so Singapore and Germany. It's very similar. Sorry?
Sorry to interrupt, but that means also basically for the due diligence, we don't have any documents up to the point when we make an offer. That means that we have to do a bit of the, let's say, research. Basically it's like the agent is recommending, of course, but let's say they will, of course, look into and sort out already from the feeling, gut feeling also, okay, this one might not be anything because, you know, it's maybe too old or, you know.
We're usually not going to get to the offer stage if something is too old. So the properties that we'll research for you will be, you know, we like to look at properties up to 30 years of age, not beyond that, because that's the age when building fees tend to rise up more sharply because the building requires more maintenance. And that's also when developers start sniffing around to see if they can convince everyone to sell cheaply. So we'd like to give you at least 5-6 years of buy and hold before that happens. So we'll normally aim for properties 30 years or younger, unless it's a phenomenal location and we're sure that we're going to get a good offer when it's time to sell, right? Otherwise, 30 years and younger, we'll want to see it within 10 minutes walking distance to a train or subway station, whatever that city has for transport. The only exception would be maybe if it's a major station like Tokyo Station or Hakata Station, Nagoya Station, then maybe 15 minutes is also okay.
Okay,
yeah, and then
I think even at that stations, I mean, if you're 15 minutes away from Hakata, you're being at one subway station anyway, right?
Yeah, exactly. Hakata, there's like, probably going to be sometimes you get this one little spot in the other suburb that's actually no other station, but still 15 minutes walk to Hakata Station is good for any tenant. And then the other things that we can see on paper, I mean, aside from just having a look at the building generally, we can see if, you know, looks like at least the exterior is reasonably well maintained. If the property is tenanted, we're not going to have any interior photos. So Japanese tenancy laws prohibit anyone from entering a tenanted unit. There's no periodical inspections, or you don't enter unless the tenant asks for maintenance or something.
Okay.
So we can go for vacant units if you prefer. If the location is very attractive, it should be easy to find a tenant for them. The advantage there is that you're getting a property that was just recently renovated, the interior. But the downside is, of course, you're buying into expenses as opposed to buying straight into income, because you still have to pay your building fees for a few months until you find a tenant, right?
Yeah, sure. I would also prefer something tenanted, to be honest, because like you said, I mean, it's like for us, I don't have any Japanese yen, right? So for me, it would be like, of course, if it draws directly some some income to pay the expenses.
It's reserves that otherwise it's expenses. Reserves that you have to transfer. Yeah, correct.
Yeah, exactly. Because at the moment, the yen rate is really good to Singapore dollar, but you never know what happens in the next half a year, right? So
yeah.
I think at the moment, the yen is at, 104 yen per Singapore dollar, which is like more than 20% in favor to the Sing dollar.
Yeah, that's so, it's the highest it's been for about 10 or 15 years, right?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
It has never been, I think it never have been so high because, I mean, I'm traveling to Japan since like, 9 years now or so. And I remember there was a time where it was in the 90s, in the higher 90s, but normally it was like around 80. So that's why I said it's actually like 20% at the moment, which is on the gain side. And in Singapore, it's actually quite easy to get yen. I mean, most of the banks, when you have a multi-currency account, actually they also cater yen.
Yep.
So for me, it's easy actually to, you know, I could even get yen funds from Japan back to Singapore, just keep them here on my bank account and transfer them into a Singapore dollar when needed.
Okay. Well, you might wanna, I'm not sure what your yen, what your bank offers you on exchange rates, but maybe don't let them convert your Singapore dollar into yen and vice versa. Use a foreign exchange provider for that.
Yeah, I will check that when it comes to that point. Yeah. But at the moment, I think it's because there is a, you know, there is a need for the banks to get to buy yen, let's say like that, at the moment.
Because good deals to be had, right?
Yeah, it's actually like it's really the other way around now than it was the years before. You know, otherwise it was always like it was very easy to get Japanese yen in cash when you travel over to Japan.
Yeah.
And this time it was actually like on the airport if you wanted to change, or also here with the big lenders here in Singapore, if you wanted to get yen, it's nearly impossible because everybody's traveling now to Japan since it's open again.
Yeah.
And because of the low and the good rate. So it was nearly impossible this time to get cash. I mean, it's very hard to get Japanese yen cash in Singapore at the moment.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I think you had some other questions about management. So management is pretty much what you're used to elsewhere. Property managers here normally charge 5% of the gross rental income, plus tax, so 5.5 total. Some particular cities where there are a lot of property managers, we can get deals for 3 or 4%. Some cities where there are less, they can go as high as 10%. But the average, the industry standard is usually 5% plus tax. They don't charge you when the property is vacant, but they do charge you when they place a new tenant. So when they place a new tenant, they'll charge you. The default is to charge you 1 month of rent. If the property, for some reason, is a bit more challenging to populate, if it's a bad time of the year or there's a lot of supply in the area, then they'll share the listing with other property managers, in which case you'll pay 2 months of rent.
Okay.
Beyond that, if it's a really, really difficult for some reason, like you're asking for the rent, which is a lot higher than the average, or it's just, you know, new developers built 5 new buildings and there's huge supply in the area, in that case, we'll suggest some other incentives. So offering the tenant first month of free rent, for example, or offering an extra commission to another property manager, which will introduce potential tenants and so forth. So we'll let you know, of course, but the average that you need to expect is 1 or 2 months when you're placing a new tenant. And then we charge similarly 2% of the gross rental income and half a month when we help you place a new tenant.
Okay, so for me, the cost would be like 1.5 to 2.5 months gross rent.
Correct. Yeah.
Basically, right? So
plus the repairs, renovation, cleaning, whatever needs to be done between tenants.
That one is very common in Japan, right? I mean, like from what I was reading online and so on, it's like basically after one rental, you have to do renovation, right?
Yeah, they call it a renovation, but you're talking about a section of flooring, a bit of wallpaper. It's not something that, like, usually the expenses are going to be on average, depending on the length of the tenancy. If it's a tenancy of just 1 or 2 years, which is rare, they'll usually stay longer than that. But if it's 1 or 2 years, you probably want to factor in something like $500 to $700 per year of tenancy.
Okay.
Okay. So after 2 years, it might be $1,000 or $2,000, something similar. If the tenant's been there in a long, long time, then you might have to replace the bathroom or the kitchen. So maybe just multiply that by years of tenancy will give you a rough, it's all average statistics, but that's a rough idea.
Okay, but that's fair enough. Okay, yeah, because here in Singapore, our experience is normally that you have to do really like a lot. I mean, like flooring, maybe not, but you know, the wall, like completely walls, painting again, doing some fixing there and things like that. That's normally quite common here to do.
You will do that if you had a tenant in place for 5, 6, 7 years. You will need to do that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but here it's even if it's like shorter. I mean, I remember when I was going here and the first apartment I got is basically like, yeah, it's even if you only rent for 2 years or something like this, afterwards it's basically like they completely have to renovate it. I mean, normally it's like painting, flooring, if it's like some cheap flooring before or something like this, or at least, you know, like the, what do you call it, like the, if it's wooden floor, for example, they will do some treatment to it and things like that. So it's actually in Singapore, it's quite like, you know, it's quite high cost that's coming to you if the apartment is not tenanted. And then the nature of the tenants is another question actually I had from my point, because in Singapore, normally for a condo unit, of course, you know, it will be most likely expats that you will targeting on. And if you have an HDB unit here in Singapore, which is like this public apartment housing, it will be more like, you know, I would say like the typical foreign workers are coming into Singapore or Singapore families.
Yep.
In Japan, I mean, I think also what I could expect is it depends also on what kind of apartment, of course, you have and where it's located, that it will also give you a different type of tenants. Can you maybe give some feedback from your side? I mean,
yep.
If... what is preferred, or what you can say from the background now? I mean, which is maybe the best tenants to have, and yep. Maybe target also maybe into that area.
So first of all, we're talking about cash cows in the sense that they're smaller, older buildings. So your tenant pool is limited to low and medium income earners. You're not going to get any luxurious tenants in those units. So you're usually talking about, so first of all, the biggest tenant base is destitute elderly people, Japan being Japan. So you get single men or single women that either never married or the partner passed away or divorced or whatnot. The kids might be in contact with them, but they're not living together. So those are always there. Because there's a unique challenge in tenants with Japan is that if they're old and destitute, they could die in the property. So there's a special insurance policy clause that covers you for these expenses.
Okay.
And then other people that move into these types of units could be low-level salary men, like people who have just graduated from university, men or women, and started to work in a company, entry-level salary people. And then you have single moms, you have more temporary workers like shift workers, convenience store workers, factory workers. You have students, either Japanese or a lot of the time East Asian students. That's also a group that has some unique challenges. They sometimes tend to just disappear mid-lease. They just leave the door open and go back to their home country kind of thing. Otherwise, I mean, the ideal tenant from our perspective, I would say, is a middle-aged or late 30s, early 40s kind of female. Because Japan being Japan, just by nature of society here, past 30, 35, they don't tend to get married or get promoted. You usually get a tenant for a very long time if it's one of these middle-aged females. And also they take care of the interior a lot better than the men. Unfortunately, the men just chain smoke and leave the windows closed and everything's just yellow and moldy. If they've lived there for a long time, the females in most cases tend to take better care of the property. But we do have strange females here too, like hikikomori, same type. They just, hoard boxes and stuff in the apartment. That happens with both sexes here, unfortunately. But that's the ideal tenant because they'll stay for a long time and in most cases they'll take the best care of the property. Employed is always better than unemployed, but again, past 60 your tenants are going to be on a pension. And we also In some cases, which are the best leases from one perspective, we have a company renting a unit for staff to stay when they travel to that city for work. So the company might be based in Tokyo, they'll rent a property in Nagoya or Kyoto or Fukuoka and just occasionally let staff sleep there during the week, and then on the weekend they go back home to their families. That's a very good tenant from our perspective because they barely stay in the property, they just sleep there. And the company is a better, obviously a better guarantor, easier for us to chase up a company for money if they have debt when they terminate the lease, right? So those are usually the types of tenants that you'll get. I can't really tell you location-wise. I mean, there are some cities that are very blue-collar, like Nagoya, Kita, Kyushu, and a bunch of other ones. But most cities, you'd get a mix of all of these types of tenant profiles that I've just described. Obviously, near a university, you're more likely to get students, but otherwise, tenant profiles are about the same for this kind of budget studio or one bedroom unit. Those are usually the tenants you're going to get.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair enough. I mean, it's good and also good for the background for us because, I mean, here it's a bit differently. I mean, most of the tenants you would get here, if you have like a small apartment, would be students, international students, mostly from China. And like the same issue like you mentioned, like, you know, sometimes it could be that, you know, after 2 years, apparently, you know, they are gone. So
yeah. Or, I mean, look, sometimes they not the students so much, but the people who come here for like to study Japanese just as an excuse to get a visa and then they just work at bars and restaurants and stuff. They have a tendency to try to bunk in seven or eight in an apartment just to save on the rent, even though they're not supposed to. So they've got some unique issues, but I can tell you that that's worse than having an elderly Japanese gentleman decompose in a bathtub, which has also happened to us, right?
So I can imagine. Okay, but that's one point. Then from the city perspective, I'm quite open. I mean, I've been to many cities in Japan. I would say like at least major cities. But is there any places that where you would say, like, I mean, if we say, okay, we're looking for a yield, especially at the beginning, I mean, if I look down the road, to be honest with you, Sif, I mean, we would like to invest more when things are working out good, you know? So there could also be that we say, okay, maybe we go for two properties, that is maybe something about like six or so at the starting point, and then, you know, maybe down the road, look for something else, because at the moment, to give you some background on the investment that we have. I mean, we have some property investment. We have some investment on shares, which is of course the more risky type, let's say like that. And then we have, I have at the moment also the opportunity, of course, to get into T-bills in Singapore, which are quite good on the yield at the moment, at least.
Yeah.
So for me, it's like, because when I wrote to you the budget, at that time, it was actually not clear if these T-bills will come out for the public or not. And actually they came out, so I could also put some money on these T-bills.
Okay.
That's just background. I want to be fair to you up front, because I mean, I get like 4.5 or 4.7% on these T-bills, which is quite good.
That's
for
quite
just
good.
Parking your money in Singapore, you know, so, and I don't have to have the risk with currency and things like that. So, but still beside of that, I would like to go also this step now to look towards Japan to get some, you know, some property over there, because just to diverse it a bit more out,
yep.
And you know, have also something for the longer run, because the T-bill is, I think at the moment you can only get 6 months or 1 year, and that's the maximum you could, you know.
What is that again? A T-bill?
T-bill. It's actually like a governmental bond in Singapore. They call
it
T-bills.
Yeah.
T and a minus bill.
Yeah.
And basically, it's like, you know, you can apply on it if you are, of course, Singapore citizen or PR, and it's like a bidding process. But unfortunately or luckily, you can say it from your point, maybe unfortunate for me, lucky, my bidding got through. So I'm able to buy bonds for a certain amount of money. And I will do that for sure, because the return is just incredibly good.
For a government bond, that's unheard of. But I mean, look, we're really not too concerned about how expensive the property is you're going to buy and how much our commission is, because like you said, we're trying to base our business on relationships. We know that if you're satisfied with a 10 million or a 20 million yen, then you'll come back with more a few years down the track. So don't worry about it on our end.
Yeah, because I mean, I just want to be honest to you up front, right? Because for me, it's like, if this one is working out quite well, let's say if we really look for two apartments, that is maybe around 100, 120, maybe 140, something like this together, right? If we're looking into that one, I'm pretty sure that, you know, we will do business in the future again. Because then if this is working out and the yield is somewhere, let's say around the 4 to maybe 6%, somewhere like this before tax, I'm pretty sure that, you know, we will look into it again because it's for long term. And again, I know in Japan from what my colleagues are telling me, it's basically you can't expect any gain in property, right? I mean,
yeah, it's good if it happens, but don't count on it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But in Germany, it's basically the same. I mean, it's like you said correctly. Yeah, there is some years now where it really went up a bit and really is steep. But traditionally in Germany, it was not the case. You know, in Germany, it was like, yeah, there is some gain, but it's not like US or other markets where it's like crazily like going up 30-40% in a short time and you can speculate on selling it off again.
Yeah.
For me, it would be really like this if the property is running good and maybe after 10 years or so, we think about, oh, we want to buy maybe another unit somewhere else and then sell it off again. We would sell it off, but it's not really something that is in our head like, oh, we have to keep it only for 5 years and then I have to get the cash back and invest into something else or so. It could be that we say like when it just stays with us for, you know, the next 15 years, 20 years until maybe it's sold off to an investor or
yeah,
something like this, you know.
Most of our customers hold them for about 7-8 years and then just recycle them. There's also the tax, the deduction claiming cycle to consider, because you're going to be claiming all of your purchase costs and depreciation and so forth. After 5, 6, 7 years, you're running out of stuff to claim. So then it's a good idea to sell and buy something else so you can, you know, restart the claiming cycle again.
Okay. Is that coming from the tax in Japan? I mean,
yeah.
Is it like internally
yeah.
in Japan? How is that working actually? Because that would be another question on my list here.
You pay your income tax here first. In Singapore, I think you maybe even tax free, but you have to pay your income tax here in Japan. So you'll be making all of your claims and deductions here in Japan as well. You submit your tax statement, or if you don't have any tax to pay, which is likely in the first few years, you're going to be under the reporting threshold. Then whatever you've done in Japan, you submit to the authorities in your country of residence, and then they'll tax you for the difference. So if you've paid 5% in Japan and you need to pay 15% in Singapore, then they'll tax you the extra 10% there.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own. But longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now, back to the podcast.
Okay.
I'm on the free version of Zoom, so if it hangs up on us, we can just jump back into the same link again.
Okay. Okay, perfect. I see it's only 5 minutes to go, 4 minutes something to go. Okay, but this, I mean, for the tax filing in Japan, is that something that would also run over your company then, that you would have some professional that you would recommend?
We'll put you in touch with an accountant, and then the one that most of our customers use is quite affordable. Once you confirm their estimate and you tell them that it's okay to go ahead, then we can work with them directly and share your documents and everything they need.
Okay, sure. Okay. So basically, I mean, from my point of view, and how I understand it, and it's like basically everything could be handled through your company for us at the beginning time. I mean, like if we then decide at one point that, I mean, if we have more properties and I say, okay, I want to hunt my own insurance down in Japan, or I find our own accountant there, then...
Take over at any time. Yeah, we don't mind.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. We're your single point of contact for anything that you want us to do. Whatever you're happy to do on your own, you can just not do with us.
Yeah, for the start, we would just keep it that way. I'm pretty sure for that. It's just like when I look down the road, you know, because for me, it's like, you know, I have quite a base there of people I know. And under that is, of course, also some people who have property in Singapore, but Japanese nationals that have property here, right? Yeah. So some of them, of course, will also say at one point, maybe like, oh, you know, if you want to, I can recommend you this or that. Then for us, the vibe would change if it makes sense. But at the moment, for me, it's like, as I said, it's just, you know, how to say, in Germany, you say, like, you know, you just get the feet into the cold water now. Yeah. You're just developing a bit, okay, how is Japan working? How will it run for us? If it is successful, we will do more. If not, then, you know, it's like, okay, then it runs for the time it runs. And then, you know, we might put the money somewhere else in the future. But I think that from the numbers for property or real estate investment, where I don't want to speculate, it seems to be a good option.
That sounds like 90% of our customers, yeah.
And maybe even some of your customers are coming from this area down here, I can imagine. Because
Singapore? Oh, we have so many. Yeah, Australia and Singapore are our biggest client pools.
Okay. Yeah. You have in Singapore also a lot of Australians or like other Westerners who are doing this, or also a lot of local... I mean, Singaporeans, Chinese Singaporeans,
all. A bit of a mix. We've got both, I think. Chinese or Malaysian, I'm not sure what their origin is, but they're native Singaporeans. Yeah.
Okay.
They all read Chinese, so I don't really know.
Yeah, you know, I think you're 70% here is Chinese, right, origin. I mean, my wife is Singaporean and, I mean, heritage-wise Chinese, so...
Okay.
And there's also a lot of things of this in the Japanese market, because, I mean, the other option that we have would be to go over a Chinese-speaking, you know, agent. And for me, what we had some pre-talks, and it's not really attractive because a lot of things we have to control ourselves. And, you know, the business nature in from our experience, let's say like this, if you have to deal with people from that cultural background, it's more difficult. Yeah. I mean, the trust level is differently that you can bring in. You know, there is a lot of, I would say, a lot more talk than action normally.
Yeah, Japan is very, I mean, the reason, one of the main reasons people buy here, except for the fact that it's very affordable, is it's a very reliable, stable, well-documented business environment. It appeals to many people.
Okay, sure. I mean, the last point that I actually had was, I mean, the document that was shared with your colleagues with me, who, you know, where there was also like an example, right? A deal analysis that you set in there as an example. And this one, from my point, I just have some questions. I think that, you know, it's easy to discuss it now while we're on a call.
Yeah, I'll and open then, that up. Let me just open that up in front of me so I'm looking at the same thing. Give me a second.
Sure, no problem.
Yep.
Okay. So, I mean, this property, the example is in Oita, right? And then, of course, the purchase price, what is the expected rent? I mean, of course, you never know if you really will get it or not, but management fee and the rest fund.
Just to correct you there, this one is tenanted. So that is actually the rent price.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, because I just was seeing another two units in the building vacant advertised for, okay, but doesn't matter. But then management fee, I understand, is the management fee for the agent, right? It's not the management fee of the building like what we have in Singapore.
Where no, so like up here, what you see up here next to the rent price, the management fee and the reserve funds, those are building fees. So okay. That's what you pay the building. The management fee goes for management of the common areas, maybe an on-site manager, depending on the size of the building. And then the reserve funds is put towards renovations and repairs for the structure. Okay. The property management...
No, say first. I will ask afterwards.
So if you look at the left column under Japanese yen, the rent management is what you would call property management, the property manager who deals with the tenant. So that's your 5%. And then the building fees, 3.6 plus 2.4, that's 6,000 yen for the building fees.
Okay, so this is basically the both amounts up there together.
Yep.
The fund that is paid, I mean, is that one also, or the management fee, I don't know which part of it, is that also covering like the typical insurances on the main structure of the building?
Yes.
Or is that something that is...
Okay. Yes, so the owner union takes out an insurance policy, and what you pay for management fee includes that, plus electricity, water for the public areas, gardening, anything that everyone pays together, kind of thing.
Is that one covering also like the damages from, like, let's say, disasters, natural disasters? Because I mean, that's one of the few points I think which I don't have in any other property right now.
Yes, but only for the structure. For the interior, you'll have your own insurance policy, which is what you see at the top there, top of the cost table, 484 yen. So insurance is very cheap in Japan.
Yeah, but it's also then, of course, only for the own interior, right? So it's basically like the interior insurance because the structure of the house itself is covered by the management.
Correct. Yeah.
Management.
Yeah.
Okay.
And yeah, insurance companies.
In Singapore, it's big city.
Insurance companies are still insurance companies in Japan too. They'll try to avoid and reduce payments as much as they can. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the. I think that's the business in insurance, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this one we will not be able to change. No, but I mean, generally, I mean, for me, it's just like what happens, for example, like, let's say, really worst case, right? I mean, let's say there's a landslide and your property is gone. I mean, if it's a concrete structure, I think it's not gone, but, you know, it will have extensive repair.
It's not worth repairing in that at that stage, usually, especially if it's something as old as this one, 1990 it was built, right? But what will happen in those cases is that they'll take the money for demolition and removal from the reserve fund if they can. And then they'll sell, obviously, the land plot to a local developer or anybody who's interested in it. If they can't afford the demolition and removal, then they'll sell it as is and that'll be a lower price. And then they'll divide everything between the unit owners. Larger units get a larger portion as well.
Of course. Okay, that was the one thing. Then on the purchase cost, I mean, what you also wrote to me, like, you know, you wrote the worst case. So this purchase cost is including the agent fee. It will include also the fee for you, right?
Yes. Yeah. And also legal registration fees and the purchase tax, which is a statement that arrives somewhere between 6 to 24 months after settlement.
Okay.
That's all included in the worst case purchase cost. And the reason that we can't calculate that accurately in advance is because the legal and registration fees and the purchase tax depend on the official evaluation of the building. And that's always going to be different to the market price. So until we actually get a copy of the last year's tax evaluation from the seller, we don't know what the actual cost will be. So we're assuming a worst case scenario, and then it always gets better by the time we settle.
Okay, I understand that one. I mean, for this, for the evaluation by the, I mean, I guess it's the governmental evaluation then. How is that one looking in Japan? Because like in Germany, in the past was always like this, that, you know, the evaluation was a lot lower than what was the market price, right? It changes now because the government also sees that, okay, to get more tax in, you know, they start to evaluate, of course, on a higher value now, because actually properties are trading for a much higher value than like 20, 30 years back. How is that in Japan? Is it more or less similar or really far off from the purchase prices?
It's updated more frequently. So they'll usually bring themselves back in line with market prices every 2 or 3 years. But there's always a difference. So depending on the area, for example, when we started working, Fukuoka City was completely unknown. Market prices were starting to heat up, but it took the government a couple of years to catch up. So then evaluation and property taxes were lower for a few years, and now they're about on par again. But now we're jumping up ahead again. So that's the game in Fukuoka. Other places like Sapporo, for example, lost a lot of tourists after the 2011 and the Fukushima disaster. So official valuations in Sapporo were actually higher than the market price for a good 4, 5, 6 mm-hmm. years. So it really varies depending on location, but usually it's going to be, I'd say, at least 10-20% off the market price.
Okay, but it's something that it's good to know. So it's not completely, you know, like crazy, because in Germany there was a time when it was really like, you know, you buy a property for, I don't know, 500,000, and it was like, you know, from the state side, they were still evaluating it on 200.
I've only seen that happen for a year or two right after Fukushima and the big Tohoku earthquake, but not since then. It's been quite reasonable.
Okay, but then it's also good to know when they're refreshing it quite, let's say, reasonable, then it should not be too far off. Because yeah. It's just for us to know, of course, also, that if we really do that step and then look into it, that we don't expect, or that there's no coming, no big surprise, right?
Yeah.
There's like, oh, this material's worth apparently like double or triple the amount that what we paid for it.
Because I mean, look, for property tax, it's not a huge deal, because for these units, you're only talking about a couple of $100 a year for property tax. Where it does become a bit more significant is for insurance compensation, because insurance compensation payouts are also based on the official evaluation, not the market price. So if you happen to be sitting on a, you know, a bad cycle at exactly when an earthquake hits and you need to get your insurance compensation, it hasn't happened to us yet, but I'm assuming that could be an issue for someone.
Yeah, okay. Sure. Okay, but this is something which is unforeseeable, because I mean, none of us hopes that there is something like this happen, right?
Yeah, out of our control completely, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've been to Japan 2 or 3 times when we had quite some big quakes. The last time I think in Osaka, I think 2019, like quite heavy.
Yeah,
like,
that was a big one. I remember that one.
Yeah. Mm. So, but basically, it's like you don't see many damages on the housings there. I mean, it's like as long as it's concrete and not wooden structure.
The worst we've ever had is a bent window frame for about $500 out of pocket. But it is Japan, so I'm sure it's going to happen to us at some point that we're going to have a total loss, right?
It will happen. Yeah. I mean, as I said, I spent maybe like, you know, let's say 4 times a year there, and then maybe maximum 2 weeks in one go, right? So, but even there, you know, I had quite a share of earthquakes that I you know, had in the time there. So, but generally, I see also from the structure, when I look at our office that we have there, I mean, like, my company has an office there, and it's like, yeah, it's like, it's shaped quite well, because it's Kunma Prefecture, Saitama.
The concrete buildings are built very well here, yes. The houses are very flimsy, but that's also on purpose.
Yeah, but it's like that. I mean, the building is basically like, it's a steel frame building, and it's like, you know, I mean, it has absolutely nothing over the years. There's really nothing on it.
Yeah.
And like I said, Kunma is quite heavily shaken. I mean, like, every time I've been there, basically there's at least something small happening. Then, okay, so basically that was this question on that one. Insurance is also clear. Then the rental management, as you explained, this is then really the agent in the specific market that is, you know, taking care of it.
Yep.
Building fees is then also clear. That's the combined management fee and the fund.
Yep.
And then portfolio
management is our fee. That's our fee per month. Okay. It's basically 2%, but we do have a minimum of 3,000 yen.
Okay, so 3,000 yen is like, yeah, 30 Sing dollar at the moment.
Yeah.
Okay. How is it when we have like something, let's say like now with the accounting and so on, if we engage it through you, there will also be some fee, I guess, correct?
We don't charge you for that now. We'll just put you in touch with the accountant directly. We basically, we don't take any, we don't get any coupons on top of works that our customers do. You just pay whatever the contractor charges. If we have to go somewhere and do something on your behalf, then we charge for the hours. So any non-routine work that we have to do, aside from being the contact person and just managing communications and payments, we just charge for by the hour at that same price, 3,000 yen.
Okay. Then for the, like with the bank account, this one is also in the document, of course, stated. Basically means that, I mean, you will have, or the money, the rental will go to this account. I mean, I guess it's your account or the account of the company, or how?
Yes, it's our corporate account. We've got 3 corporate accounts in different banks just to minimize bank charges. But basically, all of our customers' money goes into the same pool, and we issue an annual statement of income and expenses. And then whenever you want to send funds back home, just let us know and we'll send them back to you.
How is it normally what you do when you send back funds? Is it like you send them in, I mean, do you use like some services like Remitly or something like that, like some online?
Yeah, we've been with them, OFX, since we started for about 11 years now. We're very happy with their services. We got a corporate account manager, so everything is very smooth and we get very good rates. So we've also got a partner referral link. You can sign up with them via our account and then you'll also get access to our corporate account manager.
Okay. Yeah, because for me, the question will be, of course, like, you know, it depends, of course, on how the waves are. Because one thing, like I said, is like we could actually just transfer yen back to Singapore and keep it in the account here in yen. Yeah. And then, you know, just keep it there. And then from there also work with the capital from that point of view, or to transfer it back directly, you know, through a service that says, okay, we will pay back so and so much yen and then it will be received in so and so much Sing dollar with this and this rate. I mean, both for us is actually workable. But Singapore, as I said, I really like at the moment the thing that I have, you know, I have a multi-currency on one account. It's possible in Singapore, and it's quite nice because whatever is going up and down, like, you know, euro is at the moment, of course, very weak compared to Sing dollar.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, it's very nice to buy euro at the moment, while it's not so nice to buy Sing dollar.
Yeah.
So as long as these kind of things are there, because the yen, I'm also pretty sure, I mean, even if Japan is an export-driven nation, but with all the imports that they need on food and other things, I don't think that they will keep long with this, looking long into losing more and more grip on the...
I'm not complaining. Our customers have been buying like crazy since the yen hit this low. But it's always a case of making... You can actually make very nice little profits on just transferring and exchanging funds across. As long as you don't need your funds back in a hurry, you can just watch until the rate, you know, swing the other way around and then bring them home, exactly like you've been doing with the euro. So it's not a bad strategy as long as you've got reserves in both countries.
Yeah, because for the start, I'm also pretty sure that, I mean, most of it what is there will stay in Japan because, you know, of the running cost. I mean, like, it doesn't make much sense at the beginning time to drag out money because, I mean, simply it will just pay for the running cost first and then maybe at the end of a year or something like this, if there's a certain amount lying there, that you can make another decision again, like, okay, should it just stay there? Because, like I said, it could even be that we say if everything runs smooth, maybe by next year or maybe the end of next year that we say, okay, we would invest into another smaller property that is, you know, just added to the portfolio that's already existing. And then using that, at least some of these funds that is lying there to, you know, offset it.
Yeah, that's what most of our customers do.
Okay. Okay, and then basically on this yield analysis, it means basically, I mean, you're going from the worst case scenario on the top part, means like, okay, the highest, from the experience, what would be on the high side on the purchasing cost, extra cost for the purchase, plus what we have to see from the cost side monthly by running through all the costs that we have. And then based on this one, before the tax, of course, that has to be settled, will be then the annual yield that you will calculate, right? So it's basically in before tax.
Wait. Yes. So the Excel sheets, like that example in the PDF, the Excel sheets that we send to you to analyze deals are always going to show you net before tax. So it includes all of the known purchase costs and all of the known running costs. It doesn't include your annual taxes. So the property tax, we still don't know at this stage. And the income tax depends on your individual scenario. So it doesn't include those. That includes all purchase and running costs. And it also doesn't include unknowns. So maintenance, vacancies, stuff that we don't know, doesn't include as well. So it's net pre-tax.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, but that's fair enough. I mean, that's something you can work with because the rest is, of course, like I said, it's unknown anyway, so can't really do much. And then, we'll see. Okay. I think that's from my side. That would be actually all on the question side.
Okay.
The only thing now is, of course, how should we continue? Because, I mean, from my side, as I said, you know, I would say maybe that from the conversation and also from what I heard from you now, to look maybe into, like, you know, maybe one, two smaller properties would be the best for a start. Like I said, because of the changes in the situation in Singapore, I mean, I have to say maybe like, let's say 10, 12 million, maybe. I mean, if it's a bit more, it doesn't matter, to be honest. But, you know, yeah, if you find something around that.
Well, again, we're going to be, because of the way things work here, we're going to be taking them one at a time anyway. So I think we can focus on an initial investment. Let's call it 10 to 15 million, whatever turns up in whichever city we're going to see. I mean, we can put in a couple of hours of research, give you some samples, but basically to move forward, you need to email me with a name and address that you want on the invoice, and then I'll send the invoice to you, and I'll also send you the engagement form so you can start working on those. And from the moment the invoice is paid, we can start researching and contacting sellers and agents, whatever you want us to do.
Okay, sure. So next step is that I will come back to you with the details that you need.
Yep.
And then from there, we will work further on. And then, yeah, let's see. I mean, I'm looking forward to it because it's another thing to add to the portfolio. And it's something where I actually, for me, it's the first time, you know, investing into, or let's say, like, I don't invest into something I don't understand, right? And for me, Japan is always, even doing business there, it's still a question mark, you know, because of the cultural things that is happening there, like you know, these super politeness, you cannot say no, and, you know, like these certain things that is in the culture there that makes the dealing a bit differently, right? So
yeah, but it's comfortable different. It's not scary different, right? You know that you're going to be safe and stable.
Otherwise, I would not put any money there, right? Yeah. So, you know, but I mean, as I said, also over the business years now, because I mean, I'm working in the poultry and fish industry. We're making machinery for these industries, right? And I mean, it's like, it's really like blue collar. You know, you're working with people in the poultry slaughtering and fish processing business, right? So this is people that is not like, it's not a typical salaryman, right? It's more like the people who come from a career of blue collar, maybe working in these factories, being in fish farming or in fishing in general. So, and then these people over the years, you know, of course you get to know them, and you also get like, I, for my feeling at least, you have like the north of Japan is a bit like North Germany where I'm from. We are more cold people. While when you go more south, the people are also more, you know, opening and welcoming.
Yeah, so, that's kind of true.
You know, like, so that's why, I mean, we have a lot of business in Kagoshima. And I mean, okay, Okinawa is more south, but Kagoshima is more or less the most south point of Japan where you have like a big population. And Kumamoto, Kagoshima, actually, like, the people are quite nice, I mean, in these areas. On the other hand, you also know that these both cities are not really growing at the moment.
Yeah. So. Cities wise, I mean, we can go for the big cities. So Tokyo would be hard to get good yield, but maybe Yokohama, Saitama, Chiba, Osaka and Kobe. Sapporo, if we find a good deal, the winter maintenance can be a bit expensive there, but sometimes we can see some good deals there. Kyoto, Nagoya, and Fukuoka. And then there are the second tier cities like prefectural capitals or satellite cities near the big cities and so forth. Yield can be higher there because prices just don't go up.
Yeah.
So I guess both are options. We can send you samples of both and we'll see which one makes more sense.
Yeah, sure. I mean, like, directly inside Tokyo, I think for me, it's not really like, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know.
It's very rare that we help someone buy in Tokyo. It's just not attractive yield-wise.
Yeah, correct. I mean, if you would look for something, because, I mean, I have the plan, of course, when I'm further down the road, because we have some other things to do first, but to go for some kind of, like, you know, holiday home or something like this also. But that will be something that will come down, you know, it's not any time near, right?
So. Yeah.
But that one would be, of course, something else, right? There's also a target is a different one there. It's not about yield. It's basically about, you know, it's just somewhere where you have maybe some greenery around you where you can do hiking or something like that, you know. That will not be the typical, you know, hunting for something which
is
good.
It's location. A lifestyle choice.
Yeah, correct. And this one is also, it doesn't make any logical sense, you know, because it just basically what you calculate there is like, okay, hotel fee versus, you know, maintaining a property.
Yeah.
And, at the moment, this is not really, you know, up on the thing. But when it comes to investment property like Saitama, for example, I've been there many times because we have an office in Hashiomiya, which is a bit northeast from Miya Station. So in this area, for example, like, I mean, there's the typical train lines, like the ones that are going down to Ueno and to Shinjuku.
Yep.
So, of course, you see there's a lot of big apartment blocks that is just, you know, housing people that is commuting inside the city. Something like this is totally fine for us.
Yep.
I mean, like, you know, what we would look for as well. I mean, even if we wouldn't have had any help now, this is what I would have looked for first, like,
yeah,
looking into that. But, yeah, of course, yeah, we hope that, of course, with the expertise from your side, that we are, you know, can find the right thing to start it. And then, like I said, if it's successful, and I'm pretty sure it will be, that, you know, we can then continue to look for more in the next years. And then at one point having a certain portfolio that is lying there.
That's what we're here for. It'll be our pleasure.
So, do you have any other questions to my side or to...
I don't think at the moment, no. Once we start looking at actual properties, I'm sure we'll do a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, and you'll need to give us some feedback to help us fine-tune the selection that we bring to you. But otherwise, I think the basics we've covered, I think, yeah.
Okay. Sure, okay. Yeah, then I will send out an email today. I might be late today or even tomorrow because I have to join some other meetings today.
Yep.
But I will put it together also with the budget and, you know, what we could do. And then from that point, then, yeah, let's see. And then when it comes down, I have to see also how it will work out with my bank here, because I'm thinking about if I maybe should exchange some yen as long as it's a good rate or not. Let's see how we are doing.
Well, once you've engaged us, you can treat us as your de facto bank account. So if you want to capitalize on the rates and just send some Singapore dollars over because it's cheaper to buy yen now, you can do that and we'll hold it here for you until you end up purchasing.
Yeah, or it could also be that I just exchange here already some yen, then send some yen over directly. But it's depending a bit on the rating, because at the moment I don't know why, but you know, my bank is giving me a quite good rate on yen. But
yep,
it's sometimes, you know, it's always fluctuating, and you know, it's in Singapore it's very, you know, dynamic. Let's say like this, it depends really on the daily, you know, transactions and so on. But at the moment the rate is very close to the, you know, to the actual rate. Normally
yeah,
you have like a quite big yen. Yeah. And this time it's actually quite close to it. So either it's
that's what I meant when I said don't let your bank do that for you, because the banks will always be at least 3 yens off the median rate. A foreign exchange provider will be 1 yen or less off the median rate. So you really want to sign up with OFX or Wise or Compass or one of those guys. I think you'll find that they give you much better deals.
Yeah, I will do that. I mean, yeah, I will look into that and then compare, right? Because yesterday it was really like this. I had only a difference of I think it's like 0.8 yen. That was really surprising, because
yeah,
normally that's not the case. Because normally, like you said, it's like 3 yen easily or 2.5 yen easily.
Yeah.
And that's why I was surprised yesterday, because when I was looking into if I would really do now, you know, the exchange already, what would happen, it's actually quite good. And I mean, it does look like that the Singapore dollar will still gain a bit, because the outlook is not really that it will fall. Let's say it like that.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're here in any case. Let us know when you want to get started.
Okay, sure.
Thanks
okay,
for,
thank
your
time. You for your time.
Cliff. Speak to you soon.
Yeah, speak to you soon. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, so there you have it. Very thorough conversation, I thought, covering many aspects of real estate property investment in Japan. I hope you found some value in it. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com, and he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.